Inside Lacrosse podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Josh Sims, one of the most notable and famous members of the lacrosse ecosystem over the last 30 years. His playing career extended from the Severn School in Maryland through Princeton University, where he was a multi-time national champion, as well as into the MLL, where he made multiple stops, I would say most notably as a standout with the Denver Outlaws, and then continued his career from there. He additionally has worked in multiple roles within the lacrosse industry, the manufacturing industry, and most recently served with PLL during its inaugural season. Josh, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Carrie, and thanks for all you've done for lacrosse over the years, too.
Thank you so much. So I wanted to talk to you because last week you posted an essay on your Facebook page in which you respectfully asked Severn School to dissociate itself with you and all the accomplishments that you experienced over the course of your career there, including induction into the Athletic Hall of Fame in 2009, because of your disappointment and disapproval with the school's reaction to issues of racial diversity and the as you put it, increasingly toxic institution in terms of suppressing diversity, suppressing teachers' voices, and failing to provide a safe and just environment for students. And it got a lot of attention within the Mid-Atlantic region, and I think it's a strong statement, and I think it's particularly strong coming from a voice with your prominence. So can you explain what led you to make that statement?
Yeah, I'll do my best. And something wasn't an easy place to arrive at for me. It took a lot of thought, a lot of listening, and doing my best to understand the circumstances and evaluate my place. And honestly, it's the last thing that I would have wanted to do. And I know that overall, while the intentions are positive from all sides, I think that we're at a very critical time in history, and these issues today and what we're confronting today need to be addressed in a special way. And there's some radical reform, I think, that needs to happen. And to be honest, through the work that I was doing, talking to alumni, former teachers, former administrators, current administrators, numerous people involved with conversations, we just collectively felt that the school was not on the path that was going to address these issues. And I don't know that we feel that way now, and I'm speaking for a large group of alumni who have spoken out together against the response to these issues. So that's how I got to this point. As I said, it wasn't an easy decision, but I do believe that it is the right decision for me and the voice that I have and that I can bring to the conversation.
In order to help the audience understand a little bit more what this entails, can you describe your point of view on the culture of your alma mater and the relationship that you had had with it and the relationship that you have with the alums? Basically, how do you think back on your experience there?
Yeah, I think personally my experience was great. And as I mentioned to the alumni group and this group of alumni that are supporting this effort, I look back and I think of my time as being a part of a family and seeing and treating anyone with any indifference and or in a way that I would not think of treating them today. However, what I realize in sort of the introspection of that is that in not realizing what was really going on beneath the surface, I was also ignorant of my place in a culture that where institutional racism was a thing. And, while it was a passive place to be and it was easy for me to be silent, a very dear friend recently told me that when the first note's played, the song starts, but from that point on, the silence is just as important to the song. And there've been a long song for this one, and a lot of silence, I think, for a lot of us. And at this point in time, I just don't think that that's acceptable. And I think that we're in a position for real change.
One of the things that I think would be helpful for folks to understand what's led to your point of view is to contrast it versus Princeton and the association that you have there. Because, you know, and I think about it in the context of not being a college athlete, but cherishing my time at both my high school and college alma maters and the role that they played in my development. And, you know, I think about how those two institutions, you know, kind of contrast and interact, so to speak, within my mind. And obviously you were pointed in your criticism and your reaction to Severn's role in this conversation. How do you juxtapose it with Princeton's?
Yeah, and I think maybe touching back on Severn and to your question, how do I see Severn? You know, I see Severn as a very special private, and by, you know, I mention private because that means there is some exclusivity to it, where inclusivity is something that needs to be actively engaged upon. And I see it as a place where leaders are able to mold minds through leading by example. And I had wonderful examples of leadership and people that helped me shape my point of view, my perspective that I carry with me today. And I hope for the same for any student that goes through Severn to be impacted in that way. And I say that because this isn't an issue where you can just simply add curriculum or workshops or you know, talk about and try to train ethics and morality. We all have to come into this place on our own. And it's very important, I think, for young men and women to be introspective and self-aware and learn the skills that they need to develop their own perspective. And I don't know, I don't feel that that is necessarily the case. And I'm concerned that that this will become an issue that is, you know, a lot of resources may be directed towards it, but that is not necessarily the solve. So when I look at my experience at Princeton, which was an intentionally diverse place of learning and certainly exposed me to incredible diversity and allowed me to honestly break down some of the prejudice and bias that I carried with me from my earliest childhood and see the world differently. And I'm incredibly grateful for both of those experiences and how they contributed to who I am at this point in time. So I think that the diversity component is absolutely important. But for me, I've learned more through introspection, through really self-discovery than anything else. And I've just been put in a place to think independently and think critically and arrive at a place where I feel really good about who I am in the world now. Yeah, and in that last note, I feel good about who I am in the world now. I didn't always feel that way. So I think it's important to acknowledge that that part. You know, it sounds somewhat pretentious when I play it back in my head to say, yeah, I feel great about myself. But the reality is I didn't for a long time. And it was through this work that I got to that place. So
Sure. So broadening the dialogue a little bit, there's no question that a part of your point of view and platform is formed by your success as a lacrosse player. And as you transition the focus from the institutions that you were part of to the sport that you played, certainly a lot of attention has been focused on making lacrosse as a sport and as a community surrounding a sport more inclusive and more diverse. Generally, what's your point of view on the both reputation that lacrosse is very homogeneous and any effort that can, should, or must be made to increase both the racial and socioeconomic diversity of its player pool?
Yeah, I think it's a huge question in a sport that definitely requires some some deep consideration, reflection, you know, all the way back to the roots of the game and how those roots are treated in the sport. I would actually offer that I think, that, you know, and this is not a criticism of the incredible efforts that are going on in many city and urban programs, U.S. lacrosse support for those programs and for equipment donations and all of the things that are happening that I think are important contributors. You know, the very nature of the game is exclusive, in a very price point exclusive. And I think one of the things that I was actually really optimistic about when the push for the Olympics was underway for 2020, it was interesting to me that part of the IOC's drive was really for gender neutrality. And the opportunity presents itself that we could create a version of the game that is very similar. And, you know, fortunately, if we were to do that, it would make sense to migrate towards a very beautiful version of the game in the women's game right now, which I think, you know, requires less equipment, has a lower barrier to entry. It is more comparable to large global sports in that regard. Much more inclusive in its capabilities, and is an incredibly, I would say, natural version, or it's more close to the origins of the game than the men's version, which requires tons of equipment, is incredibly physical, I would argue too physical at this point in time, to the extent that it may be even considered unsafe for a lot of, you know, kids migrating from other sports. So I saw that as an opportunity, and I actually really would have liked to see more aggressive push for a completely neutral version of the game. So I know, I mean, that's not a widely accepted position, but it's actually the position I would take as a player too. I'm not in a position to want to go and play men's lacrosse every time. You know, I'm a broken old man at this point, and every time I step on the field, something breaks. So I would love to play a version where it's more about the simple roots of the game and, you know, stick and ball. And honestly, I think if we were to introduce the sport in that way, the game would be played more artistically. It would be easier for more people to adopt and find an appreciation for, and eventually play their way into. So, yeah, that's my loaded take on where the sport is right now.
I love it because it ties together a lot of different issues, and it identifies a practical step forward that brings about unintended consequences that you identify as being positive. And so, to put a couple of finer points on some of the subtext of the comment that you just shared, one of the things that I think is really fascinating about this moment with respect to lacrosse's relationship to it, and I always feel compelled to share the caveat that, well, first and foremost, you know, we're two white guys talking about a lot of issues that we haven't experienced personally and directly. So it's important to acknowledge that. But then separately, the moment in American conversation is being in many ways led by Black Lives Matter, and as a result, it, by extension, is very much about the experience of Black people in the U.S. Or in North America or globally. But the issue of inclusiveness and discrimination within lacrosse, it extends beyond just the experience of Black players. You know, certainly in modern lacrosse, it includes Latin and Asian American players as well. But certainly at its core, it comes back to the issue of the game's relationship with its Native American, you know, forebears, and the spirit of the game as the creator's game, and, you know, the exclusion of Native Americans, of indigenous people, and their ability to play the game in early parts of, you know, well, basically in George Beer's rule book. You know, it pulls forward and utilizes your perspective as somebody who's played and worked in so many different aspects of the game to identify what I think is a really kind of, in many instances, overseen or overlooked intersection of, you know, the issue of exclusivity is not It oftentimes the focus is, in my opinion, disproportionately looked at access when it needs to look at access and perception. And when I refer to access, I'm saying what you're talking about, which is price point, the ability to play the game. And oftentimes the focus is we are going to provide free access or reduced cost access for what is otherwise a very expensive sport. And your point is, why don't we figure out a way to make the sport less expensive? And that's a compelling thought. But I also think that there's another version, another form of it, which is how do we make the game be viewed as something for a greater number of people? And that's about perception. There are too many people who look at lacrosse either as a stereotype or in practicality and say, that's a game that's not for me. And I think that the Olympics will go a long way toward changing that perception in some way. But I also think there's a lot of other work that needs to be done in terms of, you know, spotlighting examples of success and you know, perpetuating those through different communities, oftentimes communities that are out of reach to the typical lacrosse contingent. But the last point that you touched on is the notion of creating a version of the game is unpopular to many folks. And I think that advocates with credibility are hugely important toward changing minds among stakeholders to make them more comfortable with aggressive change. And I think that you represent one of those advocates because of the credibility that you carry through your on-field accomplishment as a player and your multiple different stops in the industry. Like, for example, I think that the cause of aggressively moving the game forward was, among so many other negative outcomes of the tragedy of his death, really injured by Dave Huntley's absence in this conversation. He had credibility in the indoor and outdoor game that few people do, and he was such an aggressive thinker that I think his voice in this conversation would be really important. And I think in many ways, you know, you kind of emulate that or you kind of represent that from a different community. So can you just go a little bit deeper on why you're open to and in favor of a significantly different version of the game from a player's standpoint? You know, and I think about it in the context of the type of player that I remember you to be, you know, kind of that people always talked about your speed. It was this, you know, kind of beautiful midfielder gliding from one end of the field to the other. But there, you know, obviously your intimate knowledge of the game goes so far beyond that. So why, as a player, is a version of the game or a discipline that looks a little bit more like the women's game appealing to you?
Yeah, there's a lot there, but I think first I want to acknowledge Dave Huntley. I never got to talk to him about these topics, but I just, even the thought of having those conversations is really intriguing and exciting to me, because he holds such a special place in my memory, and I appreciate even the association with the way he thought about the game. As a player, selfishly at this point in my career, which is, I don't pick up a stick unless I'm using it for therapy and just for, you know, to feel comfort from, you know, being attached to the game I love. And I would love to get out and play a version where I didn't feel like, you know, there was this aggressiveness to it that was required. And it actually is something that I've been working on and have taken some time off from, but was working on a version of the game that would be a little bit more stick neutral in terms of pocket, finding a version that doesn't require any headwear and could be played as dual gender and in adult capacity, but also in a youth capacity. And that's the other beauty of gender neutrality, is that you're not only lowering the barrier to entry for equipment, but you're also allowing everyone to play together and learn the game and for what it is, which is a very, you know, nuanced artistic game in my view. So from my perspective as a former pro player, I don't really think you give up a lot. If you look at basketball, if you look at the way hockey is played, even though there's contact, and if you look at the way the women are playing the game now, they are battling and there's plenty of contact, but it is it's an equal pressure contact. So there's limitations on it. And, you know, the biggest injury we had last year in the PLL was guys having their wrists and hands damaged or broken because of slashes. I mean, it's just, why would that even happen at this point in the game? It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, a version of the game that is safer and, quite frankly, no less competitive or energized or exciting to watch is what I see as possible.
You mentioned the absence of headwear, and I know that you know, traumatic brain injuries are a huge component of the future of sport, and certainly something I'm sure you've taken a close look at. What is your opinion on the concussion issue when it comes to lacrosse?
I think it's a serious issue, and I think a lot of it goes away when you limit the body checking and the excessive cross-checking and head contact. I mean, as being someone that was largely on the receiving end of a number of concussions and still, I mean, we could have a whole podcast on that. I think it's a very serious issue that actually transcends beyond the head trauma itself into the health and well-being of athletes beyond their careers, myself included, you know, my good friends who have also suffered head trauma and are even afraid to talk about it. And I think it's a very serious problem. I think that you could, with lighter, less expensive, similar to what's worn in like flag football helmets that are, you know, lighter weight, but not a, will protect you from injury if like an incidental stick check or, you know, accidental head-to-head contact that, you know, happens in sports like soccer. Things like that, I think, is absolutely worth considering. I think that putting everyone in helmets is, you know, if you talk to women who have played the game forever, they think it could make the game significantly more dangerous for women to play when, you know, if they were all wearing helmets. And, you know, there's a strong lobbying force in, from the equipment companies pushing an agenda that would sell more equipment, make it more expensive, so that, which unfortunately would just prolong these issues and doesn't address the availability and accessibility of the sport, as you mentioned.
The last thing with respect to equipment that I want to touch on is the notion of the pocket, because you're a player who played through the entirety of the transition and evolution from, you know, a moment when plastic sticks obviously were the norm, but there were still a fair number of traditional pockets, and both traditional and mesh pockets, you know, tended to be shallower than they currently are, up through the introduction of performance mesh. You know, I blame Matt Strebel for popularizing the very, very deep, you know, kind of shooter's pocket, that bagged out dodging midfielder, and as well as the role that I played in popularizing that, by, you know, doing a lot of, having a lot of conversations with him for the public about his stick. So, you know, in that context, and obviously contrasting it versus this recent revolution that we've seen in women's stick technology, what would be your favored outcome in terms of the type of pocket that a new version of the game might utilize?
Yeah, no, I love that question. And thanks for bringing up Matt. I would actually say that Roy Colsey corrupted Matt into that. And I could blame Matt for other things.
I can see the Syracuse-Princeton rivalry emerging right now. And I would actually probably concede that you're right, given the Philadelphia Barrage's role in this whole conversation.
But they're both complicit. So in any case, I would, you know, I did... I've seen the evolution and the changes in the rules. It hasn't really impacted the game that much, and to be honest, you know, whether it's the stick shape requirements or the stringing requirements. I do think it's important to have those rules so that, you know, there's a parity to it. I actually think that the stock car approach would be the best if you could accomplish it. You know, that was one of the most interesting things to me about the Warp, was that you could literally make every stick the same. And it's something that when I was thinking about envisioning this version of lacrosse being played in a format that was, you know, very regimented in that way, I think that would be the way to go, is a very neutral pocket, not much whip. So you can't, you know, you can't get as much velocity on a shot. the release would be quick, so not a huge windup. So, you know, it's just, it makes the game quick and precise. And the way the game, you know, tends to be played, in my eyes, the most beautifully. So I think that would be sufficient. I think, you know, if one of the jokes that I've always had is my godfather, Alan Pastrana, Travis Pastrana's uncle, taught me how to catch with a shovel, a metal shovel. And, you know, it's kind of like the dodgeball, if you can dodge a wrench analogy. If you can catch a lacrosse ball with a shovel, you're certainly going to be able to catch a lacrosse stick. So I think there, you know, this idea, and you see it in young players with these deep pockets, they develop these horrible habits. And, you know, it's such an old school way of saying things. It's like, oh, kids these days, you know, but the reality is, you know, if you teach proper technique, the kids can play with anything. I used to love teaching kids to play with girl sticks with no pocket, because it was so humbling for a boy, first of all, because they couldn't even catch with it. But it was the best learning that they could have, because that's how the game, you know, is really meant to be played. So, you know, I think a neutral pocket would be amazing, and it would make the game honestly safer and easier to play in the long run.
Staying with this topic, but again, kind of opening up the perspective a little bit, you had experience professionally with Warrior and with Under Armour, and the lacrosse industry, the manufacturing and retail industry, was, like pretty much every other industry worldwide, significantly affected by the cancellation of the 2020 spring season and lockdown and everything else along those lines. It's an industry that's already gone through tremendous change over the course of the last 10 years, after what I think, you know, would be viewed as a pretty linear increase on, you know, a 20-year arc. You know, certainly since, say, 2012, 13, there's been a lot of disruption within the market, whether it's consolidation, entities entering and leaving, relatively, I think, in many people's minds, comparatively stagnant innovation, but certainly the introduction of new products that have changed the way that products are developed, and then certainly the way in which they are marketed. What do you see as being kind of the intermediate term horizon for the lacrosse equipment industry as it gets restarted with some measure of return to play?
That's a great question. It's always interesting. I mean, and I think it's horrible what impact the current state of things has had on both the overall economy, but in manufacturers of goods. I feel fortunate because I have so many friends that are still in the industry. I feel fortunate that I shifted out of it into similar, you know, into sporting goods still, but in a space that is less affected. So it's the first time I've thought about it in terms of how the industry will come out of this, but you know, I think this it is an opportunity. You know, I've tried starting businesses in recessions, and it's not advisable. But there is opportunity for those that are committed to the game and to coming out of this on the other side in a place where you know, they're ready to compete, because there will be, you know, there's undoubtedly going to be a resurgence to sport. And, you know, I think it's an opportunity for the sport of lacrosse, not just those who are making the products to support it.
And the last topic I wanted to touch on is kind of similar in the sense that, you know, you were a 10-year NLL pro, played, I believe, for 13 seasons in Major League Lacrosse, and certainly, like I said, were heavily involved in the inaugural campaign for PLL. PLL has announced its return to play with a isolated bubble in Salt Lake City that will include four group play matches that lead into a seven-team tournament. Major League Lacrosse hasn't announced its return to play formally yet, although there are some expectations for what that might look like currently floating around in the ether. And then the NLL has canceled the remainder of its 2020 season, and we're still unclear as to what it's going to look like when they do get back on the floor. But in the same vein that you have a unique perspective on how the lacrosse manufacturing and retail industry might return and bounce back, what's your thought on pro lacrosse?
Yeah, I think it's great that the PLL, I think, you know, in some ways they were built for this, being that there was no geography involved. So, I saw this as a possible opportunity, and it was interesting to me when it came out. And I think that, you know, given the circumstances, it's great for the game, and it gives, lacrosse fandom something to be excited about for sure. So I think in that regard, it's exciting for me too, having been a part of it last year as well. And, honestly feeling that, you know, we witnessed some of the best lacrosse ever played in a version of the game, you know, with nuanced rules, that I think, you know, it's very durable and exciting and fast. So I hope for more of the same in that regard. I really do think that, there's exciting lacrosse to be played. And I hope that, for the players' sake, that the opportunities are still there for players to come out of college and play the pro game. As someone who graduated and had no expectations of playing, but graduated into the summer showcase for the MLL, and then continued to play for, over a decade, was very fortunate to be able to do that and very grateful for that opportunity. And I certainly hope that, that doesn't go away for the young men and women that are playing the game now in college.
Well, Josh, we've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the Inside Lacrosse podcast, and best of luck as we continue to evolve and focus on both these emerging conversations around diversity and inclusion, as well as what is next for the sport that obviously you have given so much of your life to.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having me.